Hey everyone, I'm Jacob Cohen Donnelly and this is A Media Operator. This show is a discussion about building media companies for current and prospective media operators. We discuss business models, products, audience development, subscriptions, advertising, commerce, everything to help you with your media business. To learn more and to become a premium member of the newsletter, visit amediaoperator.com. My guest this week is Elizabeth Bramson-Boudreau, the CEO and publisher of MIT Technology Review, the oldest technology magazine in the world. During our one-hour conversation, we discussed the digital transformation of the business, how their events have evolved because of COVID, and the changes they've made to the subscription product. I hope you enjoy our discussion. While I was looking at your LinkedIn preparing for this episode, I noticed that you started as an associate in equity research covering the energy space. How does someone working at a Wall Street brokerage firm find their way to being the CEO and publisher of MIT Technology Review?
That is a that's a charming question, Jacob, because I haven't, I certainly have drawn those lines before, but I haven't necessarily done that for another person. So I'll do my best. So when I went into working in equity research was the mid-1990s, and I knew that I wanted to kind of be in the field of sort of researching a problem and trying to researching an industry or researching a field and trying to use that knowledge in some way to kind of professionally expand. And I very quickly understood that that was not a good fit for me, that working in equity research in an investment bank in New York City on Wall Street wasn't my life. That I didn't see anybody there I wanted to be. I didn't think it was a particularly good work environment. So I went off to grad school for the first time and decided I was going to be kind of more of a focus more on doing some deeper dives into certain topic areas. And at the time I was really interested in governance in European countries and what was happening with unification of Europe and all of that, which is quite ironic because now here we are on the other side of a sense of the value of Europe. But so I went off to graduate school, did that, then went into a consulting role where I was giving business advice as a consultant in technology. And that company that I worked for was a small, kind of a niche boutique consulting company in technology that had been acquired about a year before I joined by the Economist Group. And at that point, I realized that actually I was way more interested in kind of being a product and a business leader than I was being kind of the content creator or the person who made the that wrote the articles or did the drew the pictures or did the things that go behind the presentation. I really enjoyed thinking about how to monetize that knowledge that the company key employees were collecting and gaining and building upon. So anyway, I went into this consulting role. And it had been acquired by The Economist. It was then sold by The Economist and bought by private equity. And that was where I really understood all the things that you had to do to actually make money off of content. Because this private equity company, these buyers who had purchased it from out of a kind of a distress sale from The Economist, really helped me to understand, you guys have to figure out how to make it work or else we're going to shut you guys down. And that kind of sense of urgency and recognizing that you can't just kind of expect somebody else to worry about the problem, but actually we ourselves had to worry about the problem as leaders of that small company was incredibly transformative in terms of my own career path. Then went various places, had a couple kids, ended up after a few different international moves, ended up in London and hooked up again with the Economist people that I had known previously. And at that time, the Economist was again trying to figure out how to expand into industry-related content and consulting, having failed that previous time. We're trying to do it again. And so I joined as part of, I said, look, I know what you guys did wrong last time. I had all that experience in that after you sold us off. And now I know how to help you get it done, again. And so that's kind of where I got into, that's really where I got into media. And, I had been always been a voracious media consumer, always, and had been really interested in journalism and media when I was in college, but just didn't really necessarily see it as I think I understood I wasn't set out to be a journalist myself, but I didn't really have the sophistication or the knowledge to say, actually, I think what I want to do is be on the business side of media. I don't think I understood that. I don't think I even knew that there were different sides. Anyway, so it came to find out that I sorted that out in the last, decade or so. And then I was at The Economist for a bunch of years. We moved back to the U.S. and ended up at MIT Tech Review. So I'm not a young person anymore. So it is a little bit of a longer story than it might seem at first stroke.
It's still very fascinating how every person finds their way to working in media. And I love, I love those.
For better or for worse. Yeah.
Yeah, for better or for worse.
But what's great about it is that, if you had said to me at any point in the past, design your favorite professional, design your ideal role, your ideal professional kind of destination, I would have described something like this without really knowing without knowing such a thing really existed. So I'm incredibly fortunate.
So I was looking at one of your recent events, and in the speaker bio, it said, quote, "Since Elizabeth took the helm of MIT Technology Review in mid-2017, the business has undergone a massive transformation from its previous position as a respected but niche print magazine to a widely read multi-platform media brand with a global audience and sustainable business," end quote. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what transformation has looked like since becoming CEO?
Oh my gosh, it has been all-encompassing, Jacob. So let's start with the first part of that. So MIT Tech Review has been around since 1899, the first ever tech magazine set up by MIT in those, at that point in time to communicate with the outside world, non-MIT individuals, what was going on in MIT's laboratories and classrooms. And to say, hey, there's this cool stuff that's going on. This is quote unquote technology. We have copies of that first issue and, it's a remarkable thing to go back and look at what was being discussed in 1899 as technological developments. This publication has been around for all these years. And I think that there were some efforts over the last 30 years to modernize it and make it a more commercially viable entity. But it wasn't really, I think there wasn't full buy-in by the owners of the publication, which is the MIT. We're independent from MIT, but we're owned by MIT. I don't think there was really full buy-in until maybe the last 8 or 9 years about what was possible. And, I think it's because they had other priorities and, different individuals were not in conversations, I think, perhaps that would have revealed that. So about 5 years ago, before I had joined, they went through a decision process and said, there's more, there ought to be more here. There's potential. There's something here that we're not leveraging to the greatest advantage, both for ourselves, MIT's reputational kind of burnishing and kind of sharing of our message, of our brand value with a broader group of people, a broader audience. And there may be, there may be dollars and cents here that we could do a better job of spending what we're spending and earning money off of what we're, how we're allocating our budget. So anyway, so about 5 years ago, I believe, the stakeholders of MIT said, let's do something more with this thing. I joined about 5 years ago, and I had moved back from the U.S. and had left The Economist. We had moved back from my husband's job, but also our kids and family and all that kind of stuff. It was just time. And then we went through a process of trying to figure out, what does digital transformation actually look like for us? Because we were a print magazine that, if 175,000 people open the magazine, all, you know, you'd get 175,000 people who would read that story. And that's, you know, not nearly what you can get if you put it up on the web and, you know, make sure you promote it and put it in places that it will encounter an audience. But there wasn't a real clear understanding of how to do that. So, like, for example, when I joined, there wasn't anyone doing social media. They had just had an intern who had kind of, they were kind of trying to figure out what to do with make her into a full-time employee. Was it a good idea to have someone running social media for a technology magazine or not? And so it was a long way to go. I think there was a lot of desire, but not a lot of know-how. And so we had to do a major change out of who was on the team and bring in people who had more knowledge and savvy and I think passion to see the publication and the business succeed and were a little more, up to date on what was happening in media. And so that meant bringing in folks who were weren't previously living in the Boston area. It also meant, thinking a little bit more aggressively about the tech platforms we were using, both for the site and the content management, but also for our tech, our entire stack associated with marketing. I really can't think of a single thing that we didn't have to shake and disrupt. So we're now really on the other side of that. It's been three solid years of, I was talking to somebody about this. I feel like it took us a good 2.5 to 3 years to kind of get to the starting blocks. And we're now finally there. So it was like, there were things like if you have sellers, if you have salespeople, you really need to make sure they hit their targets. And they have, in order to hit their targets, they have to pick up the phone and call clients. Things that were sort of rather basic 101 kinds of stuff, to more complicated things like what is the best CMS for us to be using and what do we do? And what's the path to taking the one that we've had and that we've put a lot of investment into and moving into something else? And what's the easiest way to do that without, disrupting everything and thinking about design? I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that had to go in. So there were some easy things, there were some really quick wins, and then there have been some more painful, longer processes. But as I say, I think we're pretty much on the other side of it. I mean, it's not perfect, but nothing's ever perfect. But we are now, finally at a place where we're firing on all cylinders instead of having, a couple really, really strong engines, to mix up the metaphor a little bit, and a couple that, that don't work at all. Now I can actually say that, all of our business lines have been rebuilt and reconsidered and are, able to do what they need to do so that we can continue to drive forward. So it's just been quite a journey. Sometimes I look back at it and it's kind of like, you don't realize how big your kids have gotten until Facebook reminds you of what they look like 4 years ago, sort of thing. It's a little bit of that. Like I sometimes can't even believe the things that we needed to address 3 years ago.
I want to talk a little bit more about that because change is hard and people are resistant to change. So, you become CEO and for 3 years now you have pushed through this transformation to become much more of a digital business. What are some of the big things to look for from a business and cultural perspective when making those sorts of major systemic changes?
Yeah. I guess what I would say, Jacob, is that, I had done mini versions of this in previous roles, had done sort of smaller, turn around a team, turn around a product. But turning around the whole company is a quite a different, we're not a huge company. I'm not suggesting that, but it really did encompass pretty much everything. I guess what I would first say is that I'm pretty sure I made, loads of mistakes. And I know I made loads of mistakes, but I think that the thing that I kept trying to focus on was the potential. I mean, I know and knew in my bones that MIT Technology Review, like just take it in, that name and those three letters, that there was nothing in our way of being the most, the dominant tech media platform, except dysfunction. The market was willing to hear it from us. They believe, the market believes in the, buys into it, the proposition. There was nothing really, we had the funding and the backing in order to build what we need, and the support from our board. That the only thing we had to do, quote unquote, only thing we had to do was get the right people on the team. So I focused on that first and foremost, also because I need other people to tell me what, I can't be an expert on everything. That's not the kind of leader I am. So I focused first and foremost in making sure I could get the best team in place possible at the executive team, leadership team level. There were certain roles that fell into place pretty fast. And then there were others that, frankly, a little bit of trial and error before I got to where I am now. And I feel really great about the team I have today. But that was first. And in terms of culture, that is also a part of it too, right? So having the team leaders who then had to do kind of the same process for their own teams and say, all right, who do I have at my top table in editorial? Who do I have at my top table in marketing? Do they buy into the proposition? Are they enthusiastic? Are they driven in the same way? Do they have the same set of values around what kind of company we want to be and build and what's important to us? And again, I think there's been their own, they had their own trial and error. They've made mistakes. They've had, lots of successes, but, a few mistakes too. And so again, it hasn't been able to happen right away, but I think in general, by focusing on, do you have the right people, that has gone a mile to, setting the expectation and kind of the imperative and the culture around transforming the business and trying to live up to that aspiration of being the world's leading technology media platform. I mean, why can't we do that? There's really nothing that stands in our way. So that's what we're driving to.
Thinking about the audience for a moment, how has your classification of the audience evolved since joining the company? Or is it the same audience, just more digital now?
It's a complicated question, and it's an even more complicated answer. So, and it's probably similar to what other, traditionally print media companies have encountered and are experiencing. But so for Technology Review, largely a print magazine, meaning that, there's only so much data that you have about, the person or the individuals who are looking at your publication when they're in print. So you probably, certainly know their address and maybe ideally their email. But you don't know what kind of reading patterns that they follow. And you can do surveys or whatever, but that's, that is what it is. So complicating that is that a large part of our traditional readership, print readership, is and was MIT alums. So one of the things that we have from back in the founding is that MIT alumni receive a copy of MIT Tech Review. And that is paid for by the MIT Alumni Association. That means that we get a nice audience segment that we can talk to advertisers about. And that's kind of it. I mean, that's great. That's fantastic, and advertisers are happy to hear that. But we don't have a lot of ability to get inside the alumni audience and understand more about them because of certain restraints that we're placed under by the Alumni Association. They don't want us, for probably lots of good reasons, to be sending lots of surveys to their alumni because they have other intentions for how they want to communicate with alumni from MIT. So that means that it made it very difficult for us to understand a large part of our audience at all, really. Just the people who subscribe to MIT Tech Review in print who weren't alums, which is a nice number, and that's where the growth is, but made it awfully difficult for us to really do much. So, I think digital was important for lots and lots of reasons, and that's certainly needed to happen so that we could begin to develop a picture of who they are and who they were changing to become as various measures that we took took effect. Like as we did more social promotion in certain platforms, you know, we began to see the composition of our audience reflect that. So what we can say today is that, you know, we certainly know that our audience is obviously, you know, passionate about technology. Our print audience skews on the older side, sort of the 60 and older age group. Our digital audience is, you know, right in the sweet spot in the sort of 20s and early 30s, the preponderance, I mean. And, you know, there's lots of different things that I can tell you about what kinds of stories that they like and you know, what they, you know, where they discover us. We happen to have a very, very large amount of our traffic that comes to our site direct, probably because of the value of the MIT brand. But we obviously do a good bit of social promotion too. And so we have a nice chunk of readership or audience traffic that comes from social promotion, but we are less subjected to the vagaries of the algorithms because that is a minority of our traffic acquisition. Again, as I say, more of it comes from direct sources. So we do know, you know, we know more and more about them. And we've got some personas that we've been building up and trying to better understand. So we certainly know that there is a sort of a, you know, sort of a, somebody who kind of looks a little bit more like me, age-wise and professional level-wise, you know, has a bunch of years of experience, holds a budget, has some very you know, strong interest and commitment to technology for professional and interest reasons. But there's a more and more a larger audience that we are very interested in for reasons that are probably clear, that is a more of a striver or an up and comer, you know, in their mid to late or in their late 20s to early 30s, you know, hasn't really kind of figured out her path professionally, but is, you know, deeply interested in you know, the way technology is changing her life and her profession, and will continue to do so, and looks to places like MIT Tech Review increasingly for insights about what's coming and what it's all going to mean. So, you know, we have those personas that we populate and try to drive better understanding to, so that we can do more targeted promotional efforts for, depending on, you know, which of those different persona types we're trying to attract at a given moment or for a certain kind of story or set of stories.
Before we jump into discussing the various aspects of the business, I want to talk about the team structure. How large is MIT Technology Review today, and what is the breakdown at the department level?
So I can tell you we are 75 people worldwide. I think is an educated guess in terms of the breakdown. I think we're about 60%. I think we're about 50% editorial. And that's a combination of editors, writers, you know, social media promotion. You know, we've got some producers doing some work on their podcasts and things like that. But, you know, largely content creators within that 50%. Then the other 50% probably breaks out to be about a quarter of that 50% is marketing, a quarter is events, and you know, there's about an eighth of that 50% that's sellers. And I mean, how much have I got here? I've got about 2/8, 3/8. I've got about 5/8 left. Then we've got a team that does our international licensing, because MIT Tech Review has partnerships internationally with companies. We have them in China, we have them in Korea, we have them in the Middle East, in parts of Europe and Latin America, where they take the content that we produce and then they translate it into local language and then they publish it through, you know, MIT Technology Review Brazil, MIT Technology Review Korea, whatever. And then we get paid based upon how successfully they are able to build their businesses.
So we have a small team doing that, and we have a development team, a technology, sort of the engineers and the developers and the designers on the digital side, about another quarter of that team. That's probably about how it breaks down. I'm probably forgetting somebody who I'm going to regret forgetting, but that's generally the way it works.
And then as you're thinking about, you know, because you said that you've spent 3 years getting the business to the starting line. So as you're thinking about now starting the race, where do you see yourself making investments in the company going forward?
Yeah.
Looking at those various teams.
Yeah. So it is the question of the moment. I mean, it's the question of many moments. So I can tell you that in terms of where we're seeing the most growth over the last 2 years because of the impact of the coronavirus and the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, economic fallout from that. It's a little difficult to talk about the last 1 year because it's such a aberrant year. But if I look back at the last couple of years, I would have said to you pre-pandemic that events was a major area of investment for us. And I'm not saying that it isn't today. I'm saying that it's going to be in a different way because we've seen the entire events business just, you know, turned on its head as a result of not being able to be in person. We pivoted immediately to virtual, and those are great to do to kind of keep the relationships with the audience, and sponsorships are coming and people pay for tickets. But the overall revenue that drives for really almost a similar amount of manpower to put the thing on squeezes the margins pretty tight for events. So yes, you don't have to pay for a ballroom, but you still have to pay all the people to plan out the program. And the program can't be slapdash. It's got to be just as thoughtful as it would have been if you were in a ballroom occupying an entire room for a week. You still have to put together that kind of thoughtful content. So it's been more challenging, I think, than we could have anticipated. So we haven't, we had a pretty aggressive growth plan pre-pandemic that we pumped the brakes on. We're continuing to build out our events, but we are being a little bit more careful about how we do it in terms of staff increasing. But where we are seeing quite a lot of growth is in our advertising, and that's particularly in custom advertising. Although we are seeing it kind of across the board, we're even seeing a lot more print, for that matter, and you know, digital display than we did 2 years ago. But you know, generally speaking, where we see the real boom in our advertising is in custom content, and that's a really great place for the MIT brand to have its impact, because brands are very interested in being connected. And when telling their story, they're interested in being connected with the MIT name. So as long as we do that in accordance with, you know, various industry guidelines, we think we've got something good there. And part of getting in the right people meant getting in the right head of sales, and having, in this case, him hire a team full of people who are really good at telling the story that we have to tell, and connecting with the right brands, and you know, helping them understand the benefits that we can bring to their efforts. So the growth is, I won't say it's not about the future, but a lot of it's about the past. It's a lot of it's about fixing what didn't work previously. So when I look out at the future, I know we can continue to see growth in advertising, but I'm aware that the ceiling on advertising isn't growing as fast as it is in other parts of the business. So we have put a lot of investment in the bulk of our investment in the last 3 years has been in rebuilding our marketing technology stack so that we can do a much better job of understanding who's come to the site, and when they've come to the site, what have they done? How have they responded to the different ways that we've paywalled our content? And then how well do we do in actually getting them to hit subscribe and then complete the subscription process? And then of course, once they have, how do we connect with them and keep them make us a daily part of their daily habit. We weren't really anywhere. We were nowhere with that three, four years ago. And we then built some things kind of in maybe the beginning of my taking this role, and we needed to really
go back and once we understood better from the sort of the first build that we did about three years ago, we actually realized, man, we got to do this again because it turns out this has got to be a bigger part of our foundation for the future. So we have just really kind of finished building the tech stack that we need for monetizing our audience through subscription, which is incredibly exciting. And so we're seeing some nice growth there. But it's like only been about 3 or 4 months before we've been able to say, okay, there's a certain set of content that no matter how many stories you've read on Tech Review that month, you can't see it unless you're a subscriber. It's subscriber only content. And then there's certain content that you can see, but only up until you've read a certain number of stories, and then you have to become a subscriber. And then there's a third set of content that's, you know, and generally it's been coronavirus content that's, you know, available to anyone, no matter how many times they've been to the site that month or that period of time. And being able to look at those different funnels and see what happens, you know, we didn't have any of that built previously. But it's very exciting. So we're at like this really exciting moment when we're like, oh man, look at it. Look at the numbers. So when I look at the future, you know, I certainly think the advertising will continue to do what it hadn't done previously. But again, I'm aware that the ceiling in that room is, you know, that quote unquote room is dropping ever so slightly each year, each month. There's only so much that we're going to be able to do. I certainly see that the subscriber side of our business will continue to grow. The revenue from subscriptions. I think that the events business will, you know, we get back to world as it once was, whatever that looks like, you know, we will benefit. I think primarily because we have kept the lights on this whole period of time. We haven't just gone dark with events. So we're continuing to put on events. Continuing to do paid events. We're also doing certain kinds of, you know, smaller like evening chat, you know, free events, just to kind of keep people thinking of us so that when we are back in the world of being in a room with, you know, other people, I think we are going to see a lot of pent up demand there. But in the longer term, it's sort of like, okay, so that is all very exciting. It's all well and good, but what's the bigger play? There's a couple of different options that we are examining. We're trying to figure out, do we go much broader? Do we start adding a whole bunch more in the, you know, we're not going to run out of technologies to look at. Do we add a whole bunch of different technologies coverage areas? And, or do we think about, you know, maybe a B2B play? Those are questions that we're asking ourselves. And I probably won't answer them in the hypothetical at this point.
I do want to jump into the business models, though, and go a little deeper on some of the things you talked about, because MIT Technology Review has many different modes of generating revenue. To start, you're obviously a magazine, and magazines are advertising and subscriptions, but you also have a digital subscription. How do you think about those two subscriptions working together or in competition as you are making this transformation towards a more digital business?
So as of, I'm not good with exactly when these things happen, but as of, I'm going to say about 6 months ago, Jacob, you can only get the print magazine if you also have digital subscription. So we are no longer doing print only as a subscription. And so that means that anyone who has been in print only, and there, you know, there has been traditionally some, direct mail acquisition techniques that we were using, which is of course entirely or had been entirely digital. Anybody who was traditionally a print only subscriber, when they go to renew, will be faced with a price that's higher than what they had paid for print only and includes digital too. And that will result in, we already are seeing it, in a spike in churn. And it will mean that we will bleed out, as this we're already seeing, print-only subscribers in favor of framing our entire business proposition around the digital experience. So it's not that we don't care about print, but it's that we really care about digital and the way we have done our print magazine. And I'm not sure how aware you are of this, but our print magazine publishes 6 times a year and it's thematic. So we don't, you know, again, when I first joined, the print magazine was, it was a little bit of like the print magazine. They would take the stories off out of the print magazine and put them up on the web. But we don't even do that in reverse. What we're saying, you know, with a lot of print magazines, we'll just take the latest stories off the web and print them. We're not doing that. What we'll say is, look, each of these issues is focus on a particular theme, and we're going to explore that theme from a whole bunch of different angles. So we just did one on the food issue. It's all about food, how technology is changing food from supply chain to, engineering of food, from engineering of various things associated with farming. I mean, lots of elements of understanding what the future of our food supply looks like. Our thinking is that a thematic issue, because when you are reading a print issue, you are probably in a little bit more of a reclined sort of lean back mode, more of a immersive experience in the print and the images on, you know, in the paper format. We want our readers to be able to really dig in that way. And then in the, you know, the constant change of the cycle of the news and the this or that discovery or this or that announcement or whatever it may be is what we capture in digital. So you get us at our best when you get the two together. You get kind of the sort of the fast twitch and the slow twitch, if you will, of the two different media. But if you if you don't want us in both formats, you can only go digital only. You can't go print only anymore.
I spent some time on the website in preparation for this, and I was impressed that the site wasn't cluttered with banner ads, and there was not a single chum box to be found anywhere. Can you talk about your ad strategy on the site?
Yeah, so it's nice to hear you say that. I mean, it depends on who you ask. I mean, on our company Slack, there are various situations where people are like, this ad, I hate this ad. What is this ad? It kind of depends on maybe it depends on the day or it depends on the point of view. But generally speaking, I mean, you know, we feel quite strongly that, you know, we are trying to build the business on the foundation of reader revenue. We are very happy to take advertiser revenue, don't get me wrong, but we recognize that the business its future really rests on the experience that the reader has being as good as possible. And we've got lots of experience, you know, any number of us, in going onto a site and just being assaulted by crap. So we're pretty, if you talk to my head of sales, you know, he might come across as a little more bullied or beat up, because he knows so well what his peers don't want, him to put us through. So we put a lot of thought into the kinds of banner ads that we will and will not do. And we recently, you know, did a little bit more of a high impact digital ad, for a car company. And, you know, we had a good chat about it. Like several of us, you know, weighed in on whether that was going to be okay. And we decided it was because it didn't automatically open. And, you know, you have as the visitor to the site, I had many places where I needed to take the choice to look at the ad and listen to the ad rather than having it be, forced upon me. So, yeah, I mean, I think our general feeling is that the business is going to be built upon the reader experience. You know, I think another thing to bear in mind is that we carry these three letters, you know, the MIT letters at the start of our name. And I think that there's no question it is a blessing. It is a tremendous advantage. And in this context, it is something we have to be a little bit careful about or are conscious of. And there's something about MIT Technology Review as a website with a ton of ads on it that I think would optically, you know, be a little bit hard for our audience to reckon with.
So you've mentioned that events were a big part of the business before COVID, but even through COVID, you continued to do virtual events. I have a few quick questions on this. The first is, can you talk through your strategy for these virtual events and how you were able to actually charge for them? Because most event producers have not found success charging for virtual events.
I almost hate to have you say that out loud, Jacob, but you're right. I mean, okay, let's talk pre-pandemic. Pre-pandemic, the game we played in events, what we realized about 3 or 4 years ago was that we were selling out every one of our events, and we were selling out with like 4 weeks to go. And so one of the first things I did was raise prices, not just on ticket attendance, but also for sponsorship. We were not charging nearly enough for sponsorship, and just didn't make a lot of sense to me, I guess. I don't mind selling out, but does it break my heart to sell out, because that means there's people out there whose money I can't take for an event that I'm already doing. So we began to look really carefully about what to do in order to maximize audience and what some options were. And we were interested in virtual for all these reasons. Also, you know, if you want to go to an event, you have to get on an airplane or you have to get into a taxi or whatever, and take a bunch of time away. And was there a better way? So when the pandemic hit, we had our biggest event of the year is our MTech digital event, which is always has always been held in San Francisco. And it's the AI focused event. And it was like, I think it was like the 22nd or something of March. So you can imagine that like we were, you know, kind of watching the news starting as early as, as mid-February. You know, what were we going to do? What was going to happen? Because we certainly had seen things that were taking place in our international market business areas. Like our China team, for instance, was like, wow, this is a problem. So we were paying very close attention and worried about what was going to happen in San Francisco, and realized, you know, right around the 10th or the 9th or the 10th that we couldn't hold the show in person. And I said, look, this is the time for us to pivot to virtual. We've known for a while that there was something we needed to explore in virtual as a means of reaching a broader audience. And now we have an opportunity and we're kind of forced into it. And never will our audience be more understanding of our sort of screw ups and hiccups with the platform or problems with, you know, making it all flow properly than right at this moment when all of us as a society are kind of pulled together to try and get through this time. So very quickly, with like, you know, 2 weeks to go, the team pivoted. And the way that we dealt with people who had already bought tickets is we said, you know, we knew we had anchored them at a price of like, I don't know, it was like $2,500 for a ticket to attend the event. We knew that they were anchored there. So we went back and said, all right, we'll charge you $1,000 for a ticket. So you can either take that extra $1,500 that you paid for this ticket, but we're not going to, you know, hold the event in San Francisco anymore. We'll give that money back to you. That's one option. We'll keep the money and use it as a credit for a future event. That's another option. Or you can invite three of your colleagues and we'll keep the money. And you can, instead of just you going, you can, you know, the total of four of you can go for that same investment, $2,500 investment. So that enabled us to hold on to a bunch of revenue. We needed to go through a certain song and dance with the sponsors as well. It enabled us to hold on to a certain amount of the revenue and enabled us to actually do pretty well in that show. But by the time June came around, when we had another big event, which was scheduled, you know, before COVID, we knew that $1,000 wasn't going to work because so much had occurred in those intervening 2 months or 3 months where all these people were doing free events. You know, as you remember, it's still happening, but in these early days, especially, everybody was inviting, you know, all of us were getting invited to tons of virtual events for free. So we knew that $1,000 wasn't going to hold. We ended up pricing that event at $600. It did hold. We did really well with that. But we've been watching very carefully and trying to figure out like what price will hold in this environment. because there is such a large number of free events. And I think a couple things have happened is in the summer, a lot of event players kind of folded or went into hibernation, realizing that this crisis wasn't going to end soon. They thought, okay, we're going to go back to normal in the fall. Once they realized the fall, it wasn't going to happen. We're going to go back to normal in the fall of 2020. They started canceling instead of postponing events. So that got rid of a lot of competition for us. And then we just kept thinking, what do we do in a virtual event to make it really worth it? Like, how do we make the experience better than it would have been if you were sitting in the room, in the auditorium space? So we did some cool stuff where, like, for example, we did these lab tours. So you could go into the nano lab at MIT and you can see the nano lab is where they're making all kinds of, astonishingly small things for exploring the human body for any whole number of applications. Went into that lab, went into the computer science lab. They did a tour, which I attended, of the COVID testing laboratory that had been put together in a few weeks' time. And those kind of tours where you could definitely, you might be able to, if we were doing an event in person, we might be able to take 10 people on a tour of that, but we had hundreds able to go in and experience what the lab actually looked like and talk to the scientists who are running it. And that's a really great example of something that we can do, that we can uniquely do, and enabled us to give people a feeling that there was a continued to be a value to an MIT Technology Review event that I think has stood us apart from other event companies. I mean, long may it last. It may not last, it may not always be so, but thus far, our team has been really savvy about how to think about the event experience.
Looking forward, when do you, as the CEO of MIT Technology Review, feel comfortable planning physical events? And even when you do go physical, do you think that you will have a hybrid virtual component along with it?
So at the moment, we are not planning any in-person events before 2022, which is to say not for the rest of this calendar year. And that is, from my reckoning, a simple case of kind of looking at the rollout of vaccine. And it's hard to imagine, I think things are starting to get a little bit, like some of the bottlenecks are getting unclogged kind of as we speak. But even so, it's still hard to imagine that there's going to be a lot of the population fully vaccinated until we're talking as sort of the fall. And so maybe we could do it in the fall, but then then we've been talking about it and do you go ahead and do it in the fall? Like, try to do it in the fall and then know that you're going to possibly have to pivot to virtual, and let's stop chasing this thing. And let's just say, okay, we're not going to do it in 2021. So that's where we are at the moment. We're not planning on doing any in-person events in 2021. In 2022, we hope in the sort of late, right around this time in 2022, so about a little over a year from now, we hope to be able to hold our usual event in San Francisco, MTech Digital. I do think there's going to be elements of it that will continue to do some streaming around, so that people who either can't attend because they have no plans to be in San Francisco, or decide not to because they just don't feel, at ease doing so for whatever reason, can continue to get access to the experience of what that event is. So it probably will require two separate programming approaches brought together into a single event. So it's going to be a more complicated event in order to do a hybrid event. But I do think that that's probably where we'll go.
Can you talk through your strategy for licensing the brand versus launching owned and operated local versions of the publication?
So the strategy around licensing, it predates me, which is to say there have been a bunch of licensees there have been a bunch of companies who had licenses for MIT Tech Review for a bunch of years, maybe 10 years or more. I'm not exactly sure. But it was like most things. It was a bit scattershot, not particularly strategic. And we have rationalized a number of those licensing arrangements, which is to say we've shut some down, we've changed the parameters in order that, you know, it's a better part of our business than it was previously. There were more individuals in the world with licenses to technology review than money to pay for those licensees in certain cases. So we pulled back on a lot of those. And then did a kind of a ranking of the different countries in the different markets and said, which of these markets does it make sense for us to be in on our own? Which of these markets does it not make sense for us to be in on our own because it's onerous to enter, because there's massive cultural language challenges, because there might be some legal obstacles or whatever. You know, which ones can we probably never enter on our own? Which ones can and should we enter on our own? And, you know, where do these, you know, and what's in the middle? And, you know, where do each of the markets in the world fit? So, you know, I think we went round and around on China as to whether China was a market that we should, because of its, you know, vital importance, which I think you know quite well, in the future of technology, because of its, you know, massive significance. Does it make sense for us to be in China as our own company, or should we work through a partner in a license? And I think that China is such a complicated market, and in the last two to three years, it's gotten even more complicated because of the challenges between, you know, the U.S. government and the Chinese government has made it really hard to do business in China well. That plus, you know, lots of cultural and language. You know, differences and kind of disconnects made us feel pretty much, and we had a good partner, right? And we felt good about the partner that we were working with, made us feel like, at least for the foreseeable future, China is a market that we will be in partnership in. But we don't feel that way about a lot of other markets, particularly in you know, markets in Western Europe, for instance. So we made some changes to our partnerships in Europe and pull back on some of those, and, you know, with designs to build out our team, and build out our commercial team in Europe ourselves. And then there's a bunch of markets in which we are happy to have a partner and happy to have that kind of licensing relationship, but don't see it as a permanent. We see it as a great way to make the business grow and the brand grow, but ask me again in 5 years, and it may well be a different, we may well have gone in a different direction.
So because you're on the board of iMag, which is part of the Association of Magazine Media, I am curious your thoughts on the state of magazines as a whole. How do you see the industry evolving, and do you see it expanding, or will there be consistent contraction?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that I'm not sure about the, so I think that the number of publishers is going to continue to contract. I'm not sure how consistently it will. But I don't necessarily, I certainly do not think that people are going to read less and consume less content, media content in the future. I think that there are going to be more and more bigger publishers who capture more and more types of content within their umbrellas. So, example, New York Times and the Washington Post, I think, will continue to expand their tech coverage, will continue to expand their lifestyle coverage, so that when you are making a decision about what your own subscription stack should look like, their position, the New York Times's position really solidly and firmly at the bottom of one's stack is even more secured. And then the challenge is, how do you offer something that's different and interesting and enhancing to the, you know, to the different layer, you know, to layers on top of that stack? So if you say, okay, as a, you know, a person who cares about what's going on in the world and, you know, really digs media and is, you know, very online, I'm going to be a New York Times subscriber, and I'm also going to get the Washington Post. And, you know, that takes care of my general news, my Washington coverage, my probably a good bit of like what's going on in the world And what I don't get there, I'll get from The Economist. The Economist will tell me much more about what's going on in Europe and in Asia. But I really care about tech as well. And so what we want to do is be the next, you know, sort of that tech subscription in your stack. At the moment, I would argue that nobody really owns that spot in the market. And we'd like to be the ones to own that. But what I think will occur is that, you know, and then maybe you like to cook, or maybe you like, you know, I don't know, whatever, you like bicycling or whatever. And that's sort of what builds the rest of one's own particular media stack. But what I think will occur is that folks like the New York Times or the Washington Post are going to continue to build out their teams to take up more and more parts of that stack. So I don't think that the market is going to shrink. I think the number of players in the market will shrink.
I want to close with the same two questions that I ask every operator I have on the show. First, looking at your career, what is a mistake that you made, and what did you learn from it that made you better professionally?
I think I've made some mistakes when I've realized that I had somebody on my team who wasn't a good fit, and I didn't take the decision fast enough to send them on to their next destination. Because I thought it was going to get better, because I was so glad to have the role filled, because I just thought, you know, I'm just not going to deal with it right now. You know, cause it's hard, and it really forces you to look at yourself as well as the individual. Sometimes you might need to really check your assumptions about, you know, the way you've, how clear have I been? How articulated was that need? You know, was I too rushed in these communications? And, you know, is he or she really to blame for this? You know, all that. You know, what's it going to mean to other people if I let this person go? How are they going to respond? I think the biggest mistakes I can point to in the last 4 or 5 years have been of that sort. Just sitting on it too long and thinking maybe it'll get better. It never does.
And then if you could offer current or prospective media operators some advice to succeed in media, what would that advice be?
Keep it simple. I mean, that's part of what I enjoy about reading you, Jacob, is you're an exceedingly clear and simple communicator. And that I mean that to be complimentary, which is to say you tackle one topic and you sort of take it very kind of, you break it apart very clearly and logically. And it just feels like, okay, I get it. I get where he's coming from. I think that there is a temptation that I have suffered from to sort of figure out all the different ways you can make money and let's do this, let's do that. And I know I have sent my team like ideas. Oh my God, did you guys see that these guys are doing that? What do you think? Should we do that? I suspect I haven't totally mastered it to cut the nonsense and just focus on executing really, really well on what we're doing rather than, complicating it with other ideas. And having inherited a business that had been around for so long and had a lot of mess to clean up, and realizing as a lot of these messes got cleaned up, how much easier it was to run the business. My feeling is keep it simple. If you're starting something new, I mean, like just figure out what's going to be the you know, two or three things I want to do in a given year, not 20 or 30. And I know that's probably overly simplistic and easier said than done, but you know, find one's own version. You know, the critical thing is to find one's own version of that.
If you enjoyed this episode, hit subscribe and give it a 5-star rating with your thoughts. If you want even more, sign up for the newsletter at amediaoperator.com. Each Tuesday, I analyze the latest media news. And on Fridays, I do deep dives into specific strategic and tactical topics about building media businesses. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.